I know you all are probably worried that about whether or not I'll have enough time. But I've decided to time myself using that clock over there, which, since it hasn't moved since I've been here, I think I'll have just enough time. Show of hands. How many of you believe that it is possible for there to be a tornado in the Midwest? Good. For those of you in the area, I think you had one just a couple of days ago, so you know what that's like. You know that it's possible. I don't know about you, but I don't think a lot about tornadoes. I know that they come in the spring of the year, and I know that they happen, and I know many times there's hundreds and thousands across the Midwest. I personally have never been affected firsthand. I do know those who have been affected by it, but it's not something that is on the forefront of my mind. Even during the spring, I don't think a lot about it, even though I know that it's possible. How many of you believe that there can be a volcano in the continental United States? Now, we know Hawaii has theirs, and we'll give them theirs. But what about the continental United States? Is it possible for there to be a volcano? Okay, I'm guessing that there's a good portion of you that were alive and paying attention in 1980 when Mount St. Helens blew up. And the rest of you, there's quite a few of you that raised your hand that I'm pretty sure read about that incident and were not around when that occurred. But do you think about whether or not a volcano can occur? I don't worry about it a lot here. It's not something that I think about on a daily basis. Will there be a volcano? But it's possible. It's been 30 years since it occurred. It's something that I knew was a devastating event when it happened. And a tremendous amount of power was unleashed when it happened. But I haven't thought too much about it in the last 30 years. How many of you believe that it's possible for there to be an earthquake here in the Midwest? A lot of you. How many of you have experienced an earthquake here in the Midwest? I grant you, a lot of people have experienced it over on the left coast, but here not so much, but maybe a few. But you weren't around almost 200 years ago when the New Madrid fault line had a major earthquake in December of 1811 and through February of 1812. There were three major earthquakes in Missouri. They were significant. Now, they didn't have the sophisticated measuring devices then that they do now, but they estimate that that earthquake was between 7.5 and 8 on the Richter scale. That's pretty decent. It rang church bells in New York. It was that significant. It's credited with changing the course of the Mississippi River. Now, the things that we've talked about here are all very massive, powerful things that it's hard even for us to get our heads around the amount of energy required to make those things occur. If we were able to capture the energy behind a volcano or a tornado quake and convert that into electricity, think of how many cities and for how long we could power them. It's a tremendous display of power when those things occur. And yet when we get just a little ways away from that exhibition of power, we begin to forget what had occurred. It's not necessarily in the forefront of our mind anymore that is a possibility, that it has happened before, and that it may happen again. But there are a tremendous number of things that affect our lives every day that we don't necessarily think a lot about. When was the last time you walked across the room, tripped, and fell through the ceiling? It's never happened. Why? Because gravity is pulling on each and every one of us, on every object on this earth, it's pulling it down. And it's pulling on some of us a little harder than others, but it's pulling on everybody and everything. And we will never, ever fall through the ceiling because of gravity. How many times a day do you think about, well, I'm sure thankful gravity's here. I don't have to worry about that. You may not think about it. I don't. But I know that it's there when I do think about it. And I know that it has a dramatic effect upon my life. If it were not there, things would be very different. If it were there and just not quite as strong as it is today, things would be very different. Do you think anything about it when you take the plug from your fan and stick it into that outlet in the wall and the fan comes on? Can you see electricity? No, you can't see it. You might feel it in the right circumstance, but you can't see it. Yet you know that when you stick it in there, it will work. You just know that power is being used and exhibited in a way that you can't see, but you know it's happening. And you just take it for granted, right? You don't think about it anymore. You don't think about where the wind comes from. In John, the third chapter, in the eighth verse, Jesus talking to Nicodemus says, the wind blows where it wishes, you hear the sound of it, and you can't tell where it comes from or you can't tell where it goes. Which is true. We can't see the wind at all. We can see things the wind carries. We can see clouds. We can see dust. But we can't see wind. There are things that have an effect in our lives daily that we can't see and we may not even necessarily think about. How many times a week when you get up and walk outside of your house do you think about, boy, I'm sure glad that massive ball of nuclear reaction is going on above me to heat and light my world. You may think about it occasionally. If you're driving into the sun, you got to shade yourself or put on your sunglasses or all those things. You may be getting a sunburn. You think about it in that respect, but you don't necessarily think about the sun and what's happening and what it's doing for us. And yet it's a powerful, absolutely massive, unimaginable amount of power that is being displayed on a daily basis that we aren't thinking about. It doesn't mean because we don't recognize it that it's not happening. It doesn't mean that because we don't think about it on a daily basis, an hourly, a minutely basis, that it's not happening, that it doesn't exist, that it doesn't occur. How many of you believe that that until Jesus Christ comes back, that burning ball of flame will rise in the east and set in the west? Yeah, Genesis 8:22 tells us that, right? It says, while the earth remains, seed time, harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night will not cease. When Jesus comes, now that's going to change. But until then, we can know that even though we're not thinking about this, that heat will be here due to the sun. That the sun will rise and set. Days will happen, and that will continue without fail until Jesus comes. And then all this will burn up in a fervent heat. So let's think about the way the power of God has been demonstrated in the first century church. And I want you to, in fact, turn to John the second chapter, if you would. We'll go through several references in John. And I want you to think about when all these signs and wonders and miracles are occurring, did that solve their unbelief? Now, let's be very clear that those signs did prove the divinity of Christ, but did they solve the unbelief of the people? What happened when Jesus walked away is what I'm getting to. So let's look in, and that's the question I want you to answer after we go through this. Did it solve it? In John, the second chapter, in the 18th verse, here we find Jesus has been to the temple. He's driven out the money changers, and he's said some things to them. And then what do they look for? In the verse 18, so the Jews answered and said to him, what sign do you show us since you do these things? It's like they were looking for some stamp of approval that says the things that he said now I should pay attention to because they've been validated by some show of power. That's what they were looking for. And that matches what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1 and 22. The Jews seek for a sign. That seems to be, I don't know if it's a cultural thing. I don't know what the motivations were behind that. But they were definitely looking for something, some display of power to show that they should be paying attention to what is happening. And then in the fourth chapter of John, starting in verse 46. So Jesus came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine, and there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. Now the first sign that Jesus did was that turning of water into wine. And then this man comes and he wants his son healed. Look at the response that Jesus gives him in verse 48. Jesus said to him, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will by no means believe." I don't know how Jesus was saying that, whether it was just a statement of fact of, you know, I'm going to have to do a sign here, or if it was a frustration of, do I have to do another sign for you? What is it going to take for you to listen to what I'm saying? I don't know, but I sense that there must have been some frustration before this is all said and done, that he's got to do it again. But he does it. He heals this man's son, and then in verse 54, this is the second sign that he does. And then go over to the sixth chapter of John. We'll look at verse 14, but we've gotten here because we've got the feeding of the 5,000, and then they've collected all these baskets of leftovers from that small amount of food. And then in verse 14, then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, "This truly is a prophet who has come into the world." Again, they gave credence to Jesus because they saw some demonstration of power. And it was obvious to them that something different was going on here. This was something unique. And if this man was able to do this, then this is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he sent. Therefore they said to him, "What sign will you perform then, that we may see and believe it? What work will you do?" And then they began this discussion about bread, and we drop down into the 35th verse. Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. But I said to you that you have seen me, and yet do not believe." So they've seen him, but unless they see a sign, then they're not going to believe him. In John, the 12th chapter, starting at verse 17. Therefore, the people who were with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb, raised him from the dead, bore witness. For this reason, the people also met him, because they had heard that he had done this sign. So this is what drew the people to him again, right? A raising of the dead, that drew attention, and it was a sign again of his divinity. And that matches what Paul says in 1 Corinthians, the 14th chapter, where we see that even the speaking of tongues had a purpose. The purpose was to be a sign to those who didn't believe. And so if you knew somebody that didn't know your language and all of a sudden they began speaking in your language and they were able to communicate with you, that would have a very big effect on you. This, again, isn't normal. They're doing something that they shouldn't be able to do. There must be a power behind that. So there's a reason for that, to prove in this first century the divinity of Christ and the power of God in this enterprise that is beginning here with the church. And it happens, and it's demonstrated, but does it solve unbelief? When the signs occur, does that fix everything? The question is, once that occurs, do they ever look for a sign again? Or has it become more of a sideshow? Now, I'm not suggesting that it shouldn't have occurred. It had a purpose in it, and it solved that for Jesus in describing and validating who he was. But I just want you to think about seeing all that wonderful power being demonstrated. Is that all that was required for them to believe for the rest of their lives? To take it seriously, the words that came out of the apostles' mouth and Jesus' mouth, is that all it took? Sometimes maybe we fall into that category where we go, boy, if I just had something really dramatic happen to me that would just put me on fire for the Lord. Do you ever think that? Do you ever feel like I'm so far away? I'm 2,000 years removed from all these magnificent miracles. Is the power of God really here? Well, if I could just see something that would make such a big impact on me. Well, how did it work in what we just read? Did it really solve unbelief, or was it their wavering faith? Is it your wavering faith when you don't see a dramatic miracle and you begin to wonder, is God really here? It's easy for us to underestimate the power of a volcano or a tornado or an earthquake because we get separated from it just a little ways and we don't think about the power that was demonstrated there anymore. And we kind of get apathetic. We get complacent. Now we're separated by 2,000 years from a demonstration of the power of God. Do we get apathetic? Do we get kind of complacent? Is it hard for us to summon up the excitement and the energy about the will of God, about the gospel that saves all of mankind? It can be because we're no different than those first century Christians. We have the same struggles as they do. Just because we don't see the power of God on obvious display, it's not in our face, doesn't mean that God isn't here. Think about how Jesus addressed that in John the 20th chapter to Thomas. Remember, he's now resurrected. He appears before his apostles, minus Thomas. Thomas says, I'm not going to believe until I see him. And then Jesus appears again to the apostles with Thomas. And then in verse 29, Jesus said to him, Thomas, because you have seen me and you have believed, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And which category do we fall in? Have we seen Jesus? Are we going to see Jesus? We're going to see Jesus. But at that point, it's going to be too late. But now, while you're alive, are you going to see Jesus? Do you have the same benefit that Thomas had? You're not going to. So you're going to have to accept that the power of God has been demonstrated 2,000 years ago, and that you are going to be affected by that, whether you acknowledge it or not, whether you think about it daily or not, that fact is going to affect you. And truly, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. We fall into that category where we're not going to see a dramatic age of miracles thing happen to make us acknowledge that the power of God has been demonstrated. It's already been done. So now we have to guard against becoming complacent in this interim time, because the power of God was demonstrated during creation. The power of God has been demonstrated all through the years. It's not being demonstrated in a miraculous form now like it was then. But that doesn't mean that God's not in control. That doesn't mean that we don't have a responsibility. The expectation of us is the same as what was expected of Thomas. Believe. And when you believe, you'll take action based upon that belief. But we're not going to see Jesus in our lifetime, unless he comes again, and then it's too late. But we got to see Jesus in the scriptures. We've got to see in that the power of God demonstrated. In Matthew, the 12th chapter, starting in verse 38, here is the one sign that I think you have to acknowledge. Even though you're not going to see it, you have to acknowledge that the power of God was demonstrated here. In Matthew 12 and 38, where some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, Teacher, we want to see a sign from you. There we go again. Same question. But he answered and said to them, An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, till the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. There is the sign that we have to believe. The sign of the prophet Jonah, that Jesus would die, be buried, and be raised. And that is the focal point of all Christianity. I know of no other religious institution that makes resurrection a part of, or the validating factor of that institution. If Jesus Christ had not been raised from the dead, then we would be wasting our time. The last part of 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, spends a lot of time discussing that. If resurrection doesn't occur, then Jesus is not raised. And if Jesus is not raised, then we're wasting our time. Our preaching is empty. Our beliefs are in vain. They're worthless. Now, it may be a lot of fun for us to get together and chit-chat among friends here like this, but we would be doing nothing of spiritual content if Jesus had not raised. And that is the sign of the prophet Jonah. They knew of the prophet Jonah. They knew what that meant, and Jesus showed them by that sign that he was the Son of God. Now, that's the sign that you need to know. And that's the sign that you need to believe in. That's the demonstration of the power of God. But do we begin to lose touch with the power of God? Do we begin to lose our connection and feel like, because we don't see dramatic events, that he is not here? The question is God in control even today? Think about how you might have felt had you been one of those first century Christians. Maybe you were in Jerusalem at the establishment of the church, and then the persecutions begin, and people are dying. Does that mean God's not in control? What if you're during the Dark Ages when having a faith in Jesus likely meant your death and likely meant torture before your death? Does that mean God's not in control? Or you're at the Reformation time period and you're attempting to spread the word of the gospel again to break this world free of the Dark Ages, and you're burned at the stake. Might it not be easy to think God's not in control? God doesn't have the power to save me from being tested in this way. But does that really mean that God is not in control? What does God expect us to do? Everything he's asked. And regardless of the circumstances we may be confronted with, he expects us to soldier on. Sometimes, maybe being burned at the stake would be a blessing. If you know what's coming afterwards, it can be a blessing. A short period of time of torment, but coming is paradise. We can't fool ourselves into thinking that God's not in control because we don't see a dramatic miracle today or tomorrow. Think about Elijah. After he's done all this work and he's beginning to feel, well, his life's in danger by Jezebel, and he ends up in that cave and he's just feeling sorry for himself. He's feeling sad and alone and unappreciated. You remember how he felt? And then you remember what God said to him? Elijah, what are you doing in here? And then God brings before him that great powerful wind that even broke the rocks on the mountainside. But God was not in the wind. And then he brings that great earthquake. But God was not in the earthquake. And then he brings that great fire. But God was not in the fire. And then comes that small, still voice. Elijah, what are you doing here? I get the sense that maybe Elijah was wanting some dramatic support, some dramatic evidence that God was still in control. And God proved to him that he was in control even without the great signs. God was not in the fire, the earthquake, or the wind. Now, those were significant things, powerful things that would have gotten our attention, as it did Elijah. But God was not in them. God was in the quiet, still voice, which is where we need to be recognizing the power of God, that He's in control no matter what happens to us. So when the bad things happen to us, we need to recognize that God's still in control. And God is giving us opportunities to grow, to be strengthened. Those opportunities may be a really tough time in our lives. They may be opportunities to spread the will of God. They may be opportunities for us to persevere through challenges in our lives, knowing that God is in control regardless. And when we ask for things in this time period, apart from miracles, I'm not going to get into a lot on prayer because I know there's a lesson next week on that, but our prayer should be with expectation. But it has to be moderated by asking according to His will, just as Jesus did in the garden. As a man, Jesus didn't want to be tortured and killed. None of us would want that for ourselves. And remember what He asked. I don't want to do this, but Father, I'll do what You want. And God was in control even as Jesus was dying on the cross. That was His intent. And that was one of the places that the power of God was demonstrated. So even though a bad thing happened, didn't mean that God was not in control. And God's power was not acting upon them at that time as it is upon us. And remember the thorn in the flesh for Paul. He asked that it be taken away. The answer was no. So when we pray, we should be praying with expectation, knowing that God is in control, knowing that God can do what is necessary for us. But we have to be willing to hear no and not think that God has abandoned us when we hear those words. You remember when Jesus was crucified and how the earth became dark and how there was a great earthquake. And you remember the response of the centurion when he's watching this man and knowing something dramatic is happening here, something unusual. And his response is, surely this was the Son of God. You can't expect to see the earth being darkened in earthquakes to bolster your faith. I'm glad for the centurion that he got to see it. I hope that he followed up upon that notion in his mind that this was the Son of God. And I hope that he responded to that and that he became a Christian. But today, that has already occurred. Today, you can't expect to see that. But God still expects you to react in the same way. He still expects you to hang on to Him and believe in Him and to know, even though you may feel like everybody's out to kill you and you're hiding in a cave, God is still in control. And you're still here to do His will. Probably the best capstone to this entire subject comes in Ephesians, the third chapter, in the 20th verse. Now to Him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think. We can't even imagine things that God can do. You know what? It's impossible for us to overestimate God, but it's very easy for us to underestimate Him. But here, we're being told to give honor to God as the one who is capable of doing so much more than even our wildest imagination can bring forth. And we're to honor Him. To Him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think. Verse 21, to Him be glory in the church by Jesus Christ for all generations, forever and ever. Amen. We have got to know that God is there. And that just because we haven't seen a demonstration of His power for many years, in our lifetimes never, it doesn't mean that it's not here. And it doesn't mean that God's not in control. It doesn't mean that He doesn't care about us. It doesn't mean that we're alone. Because at some point in time, His power will be demonstrated again. It was demonstrated in the creation. It was demonstrated consistently through the years. And it will be demonstrated again. God didn't wear Himself out at creation. He didn't wear Himself out on any of these demonstrations of power. Once again, it will come. And at that time, then this world will melt with the fervent heat. 2 Peter, the third chapter, verses 10 through 12. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, And the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works in it will be burned up. So we know that that demonstration of power will occur. At some point in the future, it will occur. And here comes the question then to you. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of the Lord? When Jesus comes, this earth will burn up. The question is, since you know that, since you know that God has demonstrated his power in the past and he will again in the future, and you know that it means the destruction of this world and everything that you see around here that you may think is great is going to be gone. So Peter's asking a question. Should you live? What should your response be to that? See, it demands something of you. If you know destruction is coming, then you know you need to respond in some fashion. So I would encourage you not to underestimate God, to know that he is in control, to know that he will exercise his power again. And I will give you an opportunity this morning as we stand and sing to come forward. If you believe that that God's power will be demonstrated in the destruction of this earth, and you know that that demands something of you in your conduct and in your godliness, then this is your opportunity to come forward. Recognize that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that his sacrifice is what gives you the power over sin. And you can be converted, you can be baptized, you can become a part of the body of Christ and not fear those elements melting with a fervent heat. Please come forward as we stand and sing the invitation song.